You're listening to the Mormon Expression Podcast. Find us on the web at mormonexpression.com.
Mormon Expression is made possible through your generous support. Consider a subscription or a donation today.
And thanks. It's time for the annual Listener Essay Contest.
Essays must be recorded in any audio format and be less than 10 minutes, dealing with any topic in Mormonism.
And the winner will receive a $100 prize.
Essays may be submitted by sending a message to mail@mormonexpression.com.
We look forward to hearing your entries and good luck.
And finally, the Mormon Expression annual live event will be August 6, 2011 in Salt Lake City.
It's going to be a fabulous evening filled with music and the spoken word.
Get your tickets now by going to mormonexpression.com/tickets on our website.
We look forward to seeing everybody there.
Welcome back to another edition of Mormon Expression. I'm your host, John Larson. And tonight we have another great panel to discuss another great topic. First of all, we have Alisa. Welcome back, Alisa.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Now, you've been with us a couple times, mostly with the books, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Did Mormon Enigma.
All right. Well, this is kind of like a book tonight. And then joining us for Travis, I can't even remember where you're at. Where are you at?
I am down in Texas.
Oh, wow, Texas. Well,
yeah.
Welcome to Mormon Expression. Again, you were with us when we talked about Saturday's Warrior.
That's right, yep.
Well, I'm glad to have you back.
Good to be back.
And Heather, you're starting to rack up your appearances. Welcome.
Yeah, I'm starting to become a regular, I think. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And then batting cleanup is... Zilpha. Hi, Zilpha.
I don't even know what that means, so how can I do it?
Batting cleanup?
No, I don't know what that means.
Oh, wait. I'll explain to you later.
That's a good idea.
So tonight, this is another one that we've been talking about doing for a long time. I've been looking forward to. We're going to talk about Battlestar Galactica.
Woo!
And I don't know if we'll get as much into the new series. They restarted in like 2001, 2003.
Mm-hmm. Which was an excellent series.
Oh, yeah.
Very well done. Very well acted.
It's a fun one. Mm-hmm. But we're going to talk about the original from 1978.
Oldie, but a goodie.
Well,
yeah, I did. I actually didn't know there were two until fairly recently. My first time hearing about Battlestar Galactica, I was reading Holly Welker's dissertation. She was on, I think, talking about the new Mormon ad campaign. Uh-huh. But in her dissertation, she talked about a Sunday school teacher who would constantly make references to Battlestar Galactica, and it annoyed her. And then soon after that, my brother called me. He's like, "Have you been watching Battlestar Galactica?" And I was just in my head, "Isn't that kind of old? What is it, in reruns?" You know, after several decades. But I appreciate this opportunity where I was finally able to watch them.
Yeah, luckily, and maybe this spawned it. It is available on Netflix for streaming. Actually, the whole both the new and the old. So you can all run out to Netflix and watch the original series.
Spend a few months with Battlestar Galactica.
So before we talk about the original series, let's talk a little bit about Glenn Larson. Glenn A. Larson was a big-time producer during that era. And he came up with a lot of shows that if you watched TV in the early 80s, you probably watched. The most famous ones were Battlestar Galactica. Right after that, he did Buck Rogers, which was kind of a more comedic version. And I read on the internet that they reused the sets. Did The Fall Guy, which was Lee Majors, the $6 million man's triumphant return to TV. And he did Knight Rider.
Knight Rider.
And you can't forget Magnum P.I.
Yeah. Oh, yes, and Magnum P.I.
Wow.
I was going to point out that both the Cylons and Kit, the car in Magnum P.I. yeah, have the Cylon shuffle or whatever, the little light that goes back and forth.
Kit, the car, and Knight Rider, not Magnum P.I.
Which I heard has been dubbed the Larson Scanner.
The Larson Scanner, yeah. So he wouldn't give up on the ideas, I guess. Now, good old Glenn was a Mormon, and I have not found any evidence to suggest that he was ever, when I was a kid, they always said he was an inactive Mormon or, you know,
oh,
but he has done several interviews where he's talked openly about his Mormonism. And the best I can tell, he stayed sort of loyal in that sense. He never threw Mormonism under the bus. And it's clear from Battlestar Galactica that he was a big fan. So Glenn, I don't know. This was his big TV breakout. I'm not sure he has. If you go into IMDb, I'm sure you can find a lot of stuff he did before. But this was his big show, Battlestar, yeah, and obviously he helped write it all through the season.
Well, he started writing it back in the late 60s, if I remember right. And one of the writers from Star Trek was helping him out for a little bit. And
yeah, he spent a lot of years writing the script, and then. And then I don't know where they got the funding, but it was like $1 million per episode or something horrific.
Well, I think the important thing to keep in mind is like 1977 is Star Wars, you know, so suddenly there's a budget for science fiction pieces like this. One other thing I wanted to say that was interesting to mention was that in July 1977 in The Ensign, Spencer W. Kimball put out an article called The Gospel Vision of the Arts, in which he essentially called for Mormon artists to step up to the plate and represent the gospel on film or in other artistic mediums. And I can't help but see, like, could Glenn A. Larson have been thinking, that's me he's talking to, that's a prophetic charge to me, you know? And science fiction is really kind of an ideal medium for didacticism. So kind of a good fit there.
Yeah. And of course, yeah, it's right after Star Wars. 20th Century Fox actually sued. And you can read things about that. And then which studio produced Galactica? Do you guys remember?
Universal?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Universal countersued and said, well, you know, Star Wars took all the stuff out. And of course, George Lucas claimed one of his big influences was the Hero with 1,000 Faces and then samurai movies. So he was pulling in all this sort of cultural stuff. And while Galactica has a whole bunch of Mormon things in there, it also pulls from Greek mythology and from other myths that are around. And especially the reboot. The reboot really doesn't have as much to do with Glenn Larson's Pearl of Great Price Mormonism as it does sort of a play on Greek mythology.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. The remake, you know, there's traces of Hinduism and it's it kind of strips away the Mormon elements.
It does. So, well, let's, no further ado, with Glenn Larson established as a Mormon. And this is not secret. I mean, everybody knew, and Glenn, I think, openly talked about the fact that they were putting Mormon elements into this. So it's not like Orson Card trying to sneak this stuff into fiction. And by the way, do you guys read Orson Card's review? He hated it. He hated Battlestar.
Yeah, I actually wrote down a couple of those quotes.
Yeah, there's some funny ones.
Yeah, he really didn't like it. But I've just got to say, before we like get into all the discussion of the actual show, I was secretly hoping the whole time I was preparing for this podcast that you were actually related to Glenn Larson.
No, he's got an O and I'm an E. He's a Swede.
Oh.
And darn. I'm a Dane.
Yeah,
sorry.
I was hoping we'd show up here and you'd be like,
I'm so glad someone asked that question.
Introducing.
Yeah, he's going to join us on the podcast tonight.
No, and I have to admit, I didn't dig really deep, but I didn't get a lot of background on, you know, Glenn and where he came from and all that sort of stuff. So I'll just leave it at the fact that he obviously is a big fan of the Pearl Great Price.
And has a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame.
He does, yeah. And he was a consulting producer. Now I've heard before that when you see executive producer, that means you lent your name to it and you cash the checks, but you don't do anything else. So I don't know how much he did consult with the reboot of the series, but he was definitely involved in the first one.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So not everybody who listens to this podcast grew up in Zion. So let's start from the beginning. Let's start with the Pearl of Great Price. You look like you had something to say, Zilpha.
No.
So the Pearl of Great Price. So Joseph Smith. Let's go back. I like to always tie it all together. Joseph Smith writes the Book of Mormon and publishes in 1830, and then shortly thereafter he writes the Book of Moses, which is part of the Pearl of Great Price. And he doesn't make any, like, there's no head in the hat. There's no stones. There's no like mummies. He just writes the damn thing
with partners. He had. A group of them worked together on it.
Yeah. So, and he just said, hey, I got this directly from heaven, blah, blah, blah.
While he was working on the Joseph Smith translation of the Bible, right?
Yeah. That was one of the first things they did. But fast forward, a little while, and in Kirtland, I can't remember the guy, Chandler or whatever, is coming through town with the mummies.
Oh, I guess I was confused. That's when he had help. I don't know about the Moses.
Oliver helped him. Oh, he was translating the Bible when he wrote the Moses in 1830. So he gets these mummies, and of course, this is right about the time of the discovery of the Rosetta Stone. So everybody, I think it was after Napoleon that sort of the Western world got really interested in Egyptology. And, you know, there's these big monuments and great big statues, and you know, they'd appear in the magazines and stuff like that. So it sort of sparked everybody's imagination. And of course, the Bible talks quite a bit about the Egyptians in the books of Moses, you know, and the Israelites and blah, 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 blah. So Joseph Smith used that as sort of a vehicle. He claims to have translated the papyri that were with the mummies. There's these burial things, and you know that we know exactly what they say now. There's no secret. They say nothing about what's in the Pearl Great Prize, but Joseph Smith claimed to translate them, and we got the Book of Abraham from that. Mm-hmm. And the Book of Abraham is full of all sorts of crazy, and that's sort of the doctrinal basis for this. And one of the things that now you guys can all help me. The term when someone uses scripture and riffs on it is called pseudepigrapha. Thank you. And there's a long, long tradition of this, of writing scripture in first person, dating well after the supposed origin of the scripture. And a lot of the apocrypha and a lot of the documents like the Gnostics used, it was a very common thing to write in the voice of whoever it is you're doing. And that's sort of what Joseph was doing. But I want to be clear that a lot of people accuse Joseph of doing the same kind of thing that Hubbard did, L. Ron Hubbard, with Scientology. But Hubbard was smack in the middle of this sort of scientific science fiction movement. And Joseph Smith really predated that. What he was doing is a riff on the Bible as opposed to following the scientific traditions. And he was a little bit ahead of you. Maybe you guys can correct me if I'm wrong. The name just escaped me. The War of the Worlds guy and the Time Machine.
Orson Welles.
But who was before that? Anyway, Joseph Smith was a little bit before the earliest scientific science fiction. So it's really, I think it's erroneous to accuse Joseph Smith of playing on that. You'd have to accuse him of sort of inventing it more, because he was way earlier than that.
Yeah, I agree. I think there'd have to be much more. There'd have to be more alien talk. It's much more taken from the Bible with angels and God and what happened in, you know, with Moses and Abraham in those books.
Yeah.
Well, and Joseph was always trying to create a kind of a quilt out of all the little pieces that he could gather. And he wanted everything to be explained, and he wanted the mysteries to be known. And these were some of the mysteries. Who is God? What is God? Where is God? Where did we originate? These kinds of questions he was trying to get answers for.
And what Joseph Smith was doing is taking these ideas from the Old Testament and infusing them with 19th century cosmology. And if you read it, it really reads straight out of the 19th century. I mean, there's things, you know, there's things that it talks about that were common understanding at that point that we've proven wrong, that people in Moses's era or Abraham's era wouldn't have known about. So it fits right in that period. And you can see other influences, and you know, this is a topic for another day. But at the time, Joseph Smith was studying the Hebrew grammar, and some of the words he uses are play on Hebrew and not necessarily Egyptian. It's clear Joseph Smith knew nothing about Egyptian whatsoever. But that being said, the foundation, there's a cosmology, and we take God sort of out of the realm of, I don't know, the otherworldly, the other bodily, and sort of place him and the history of mankind in the universe. And that's really what Abraham does. And one of the things that it does is it starts and says there is this star that is right near where God, the planet that God lives on.
He says, where God dwells.
Yeah, you're right. I need to avoid my own. The idea that God was a man was a later after the book of Abraham.
And that he lived on a planet. It doesn't say that. It just says that it's the star closest to where God dwells.
And that star is called Kolob.
Later speeches, like church leaders just started to use Kolob as like as the place where he was. Like later on, it just kind of would merge together. They wouldn't make the distinction that Kolob is a star near. It's just like when we return to Kolob, if you read the Journal of Discourses.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And yeah, a lot of people make that mistake even today. They say, oh, Mormons say God lives on Kolob. Not really. Right. Kolob is the great governing star.
But a lot of prophets like Brigham Young said that. I don't know. We're having some kind of burping problem here.
Kolob is the great governing star, and the entire universe is this mechanical watch-like mechanism that all is centered around this thing, which governs. And he talks about greater lights giving light to lesser lights and blah, 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 and this power that gets transferred in this sort of pseudo-mechanical way that I'm sure was very satisfying to the people in the 19th century, but we read it today and say, well, that doesn't clear anything up at all. You know, it's like the, you know, the elephant on the back of a turtle sort of answer. Mm-hmm. But it's not turtles all the way around, because Kolob is the great governing star, because that's the center of the universe. So,
but I think it's something you have to grapple with if you're teaching, if you're cultivating a theology of embodied God, that body that, you know, as you've referred to in earlier podcasts, that is leg hair and elbows and spleen. It has to be somewhere, and placing God within the universe in an actual location.
So now we can get back to Battlestar Galactica. So instead of saying Kolob, I don't know why he changed this, but he did an anagram of it and said Kobol. Mm-hmm. And in the Battlestar, Kobol is the great planet and the origin. I find the quote here. Maybe you're fast. You guys are faster.
Where man began or something.
The lost planet of ancient gods is what it's referred to.
Oh.
And that is the planet where all life began. So Kobol is the great center of all the happenings in the Galactica universe.
Interestingly enough, it also has a city that is now abandoned, but a city called Eden, which had a really interesting quote about it that said it was like the first to fall or something like that.
The first
like
to
that.
Fall, yes. Mm-hmm. Eden was the first to fall. So we see that whole theme of that central planet and that central access of the universe play out in both of these. So that's kind of its first Mormon thing. So we can talk more about as we go on with the Pearl Great Prize, but I want to establish that Kolob is the origin of the gods.
Kobol.
I could hi to Kolob. I'll use them interchangeably. Okay. So the gods themselves, and there's the implication there. And I think it was later in one of the shows, where they talk about, they actually even use the words as you once were, we, or as
right.
I'm looking down my notes.
Well, right, where one of the characters is rescued by these light figures in white, and so he's talking. They're talking about how they're just like them, but differ by degrees. Mm-hmm. And they had been battling this other figure who had been talking about that he's greater. He's a being greater than them by degrees. So playing on this idea how bodies and spirits and gods, angels, we're all the same creatures or in types of individuals, but just differ in glory or by degrees. But yes, they introduce as you are, we once were, as we are, you may become.
In the very dramatic style of the of
right.
The time.
There's a lot of godlike voices, which I think you played in the opening to this episode. Is that what we were saying?
We played the music and there was a godlike voiceover that came over every time, and I will play.
You're like, am I in the temple? It starts with space, and then you know,
it does. you know, as a piece of trivia, you guys know the early Temple film, that the space was from Fantasia. So,
no.
Yeah, yeah, you can look that one up. Funny. But, yeah, so it starts with this space, and then there's this voice that comes in. I'll play it right now.
There are those who believe that life here began out there, far across the universe, with tribes of humans who may have been the forefathers of the Egyptians, or the Toltecs, or the Mayans. Some believe that there may yet be brothers of man who even now fight to survive somewhere beyond the heavens.
So we hear this sort of origin, this mysterious, here we are, here's the regression that what the Toltec and the Maya and the Egyptian, significant that it's those three in Mormonism, may have some ancient other origins. And that's where, you know, we talked in the beginning about that science fiction sort of thing, where here I think you see Glenn taking these ancient ideas or these older ideas from Joseph Smith and sort of infusing them with a 1970s vibe and saying, well, how would this stuff play out? And now that we have ideas of space travel and the Apollo landing, which of course appears in the final episode, sorry, spoiler alert, and all that stuff, how would that play out? Because when you have that idea of God is a man, then obviously the stuff that we do is going to somehow intermix into the theology.
So,
and it, oh, excuse me.
Sorry, I was just going to say maybe we should, for those who haven't seen the show, explain how COBOL and Earth are connected. There were the gods that were on COBOL, and I don't know if they created the different races and then dispersed them to the planets, or if they seeded the life on the other planets, but I'm guessing they created them and then they dispersed after Eden fell to go to the different planets. And the planets of the people who were in Battlestar Galactica are named after different...
kind of the signs of the Zodiac.
Yeah, the signs of the Zodiac. Mm-hmm. And they are looking for their lost tribe. So it kind of brings in the whole tribes of Israel and the lost tribes. And the people on Battlestar Galactica are trying to find the lost tribes, and they just so happen to be the ancient peoples that are ever so conveniently discussed in the Book of Mormon.
Yeah, yeah. That this is where we get a tie between the Book of Mormon. There's not a lot, you know, the Book of Mormon, I've said before, doesn't have a lot to do with Mormon theology, but there is the idea of this small band of chosen that is out seeking, and the idea of the lost tribes sort of enters into that. But most people who aren't Mormon sort of get it screwed up when they're talking about the Book of Mormon. But yeah, you're right. So the 12 tribes disperse from this origin in heaven. And I think this is where we can go back to the Book of Abraham, because the Book of Abraham really picks up the story. It talks about this cosmology we were referring to a few minutes ago, but then it picks up, and the Book of Abraham is sort of this play on the post-Noahic world. So the Noahic flood comes about, and then the Book of Mormon has these just-so stories about where Egypt came from. You know, it says Egyptus was the daughter of Pharaoh, and when she found Egypt, it was underwater. And what they said, that the Egypt means that which is hidden, or some cockamamie stuff like that. So you have this, and as a matter of fact, the original name of the series was Adama's Ark. Of course, mm-hmm. Adama is a play on the word Adam. Mm-hmm. So you have this start. And why that becomes important is because in Mormon theology, the Egyptians come back time and time again. And in the Book of Abraham, it said that the Egyptians were not allowed to have the priesthood, of course, because they were black, because they descended from Ham, who preserved the curse in the land, from Cain, who's Bigfoot. So they couldn't have it, but they tried to rip it off, right? So if you read Nibley, you know, he'll talk about you can see all this Egyptian stuff, because they tried to create the endowment and they tried to create the temple stuff, but it was a counterfeit because they weren't allowed. Now in Battlestar, like, their helmets look rather pharaohic.
Yeah, very Egyptian. They look like the Sphinx, mm-hmm. I think.
And they have like cubits, and they have, and the color scheme, and it's...
Well, there were, you know, the episode, The Lost Planet of the Gods, where they actually go to COBOL, that was actually filmed in Egypt, interestingly enough. And yeah, so they're looking at Egyptian tombs and things like that, and
hieroglyphics. Mm-hmm.
Right, right. So, yeah, there's a real sort of Egyptian vibe. And that's something that would really resonate with people who grew up in the church. Because, you know, you see those Egyptian facsimiles right there in the Book of Abraham. So not only do you get this talk about, you know, you have real like Egyptian art, albeit somewhat modified. So, and that's where that voiceover comes in. You know, the Maya, of course, Mormons believe basically are the Nephites and the Lamanites. And then the Egyptians have this connection to this ancient order of things. So for Mormons, that's really resonant.
And I think it's exciting with the going back to that narration where he talks about came from somewhere out there. And I think, and for me, that was exciting growing up in the church, just realizing that God as an embodied being was somewhere out there. And I can see, particularly with Battlestar Galactica, it's kind of that Mormon fantasy of getting the technology where you're able to explore space. And then you start reaching the point where you're going to have angelic, you're going to be crossing the paths of angelic beings and entering this world near God, and the whole battle between good and evil in a very real, physical way, tangible way, excuse me.
I actually had that. I always tried to make Mormonism make sense scientifically and with technology. And I remember telling my friends that it wouldn't bother me or surprise me at all if Christ came down, you know, in a spaceship, or if when we were taken up to heaven, it was in a spaceship to go to Kolob. So it definitely, I think, does feed into that fantasy and, you know, in the Mormon audience.
Well, I think that's why Mormonism works so well within science fiction. Mm-hmm. I mean, because science fiction specifically is supposed to naturalize the supernatural. It's supposed to, you know, there are these extraordinary powers that create an alien or a monster or something, but you have to be able to explain it. Whereas other genres, fantasy or horror film, you know, the monster just is, or the good and evil just is. But I think in many ways, Mormonism, theologically or in a religious way, is trying to do the same thing of understanding the supernatural essence of God and trying to naturalize it, or breaking it down that we can become gods as well. And I heard one writer just saying that you don't find that doctrine of becoming gods in theological journals, but you can find that more in science fiction and where it is acceptable there.
Yeah, and I agree with all that. And I think science fiction and horror become this play out, especially as we become a more secular society. I've heard it argued before that the one of the reasons that the horror genre, for example, has become so popular is because horror proves the existence of afterlife. You know, you've got things coming from beyond the grave. It proves the existence of evil, which therefore implies the existence of good. And you see that same sort of thing in science fiction, where these abstract ideas are played out right there. And that's, again, what I'm saying with Glenn Larson is he took these abstract ideas from the Book of Abraham, and he showed a plausible way that these things could play out in the real world.
Exactly.
So I think that's a really good point. So let's talk a little bit more about the 12 tribes, because that's something that really has a strong undercurrent through all of Mormonism that I think people downplay today, and I think outsiders probably don't understand very well. And we'll talk a little bit about some speculative theology too, which is fun. So today in the church, when you come near coming of age, you're going to get your patriarchal blessing. But there's a key element in that for especially people who are raised in the church, and that's that you get adopted into one of the 12 tribes. So for Mormonism, the 12 tribes weren't just something that was this ancient order of God's chosen people, but it's something that is real and alive today. And when they talk about the gathering and the lost 10 tribes and all that sort of stuff, it becomes very concrete and very real and very in the present, because you're going to become one of the members of one of those tribes.
Right. It's like taking the Old Testament model and placing it into current times. I mean, Joseph Smith did not want to lose anything if he could help it. So he took the things that were important in the Old Testament and kind of resurrected them for for a new generation.
And he made them essential.
Yeah.
You have to, that goes back to the whole Abrahamic covenant. Hi, Mike. You have to be adopted into a, you have to be adopted into a tribe. You, it all has to be grafted in. So you're one big plant or chain or whatever.
Right. Otherwise you,
blow in the wind.
Yeah.
You're outside the city wall.
Yeah. And of course the, it talks about the lost 10 tribes in the Book of Mormon. And then that's a theme today and the theme of gathering. And gathering in the lost 12, 10 tribes. Although I always tease Mormons that they talk about the lost 10 tribes, but I'll ask them, well, which two aren't lost? And they almost all get the answer wrong. Zilpha, can you get the answer right? Which, according to the Bible, which two tribes are not lost?
Oh, because there's 10 missing. Well, isn't it Ephraim, Manasseh? I mean, that's part of...
That's what a lot of Mormons
but that's
say.
Part of Jacob, right? Or...
Elisa Joseph? Was getting the answer right.
Oh, me? No.
Or I thought it was Heather.
Oh, was it Heather? Sorry.
I think Joseph and Judah.
It's Judah and Benjamin. I mean, Benjamin. It's really, you know... But
what about
you
have, Joseph? Joseph?
I know, I hear different
Ephraim,
answers.
Ephraim
like, even
Manasseh.
The Encyclopedia of Mormonism said it was Judah and the Lamanites.
Well,
I was like, that's the first time I've ever heard that.
We probably need to have a podcast on that, because it has to do with the North Kingdom and the South Kingdom. And
exactly,
the North Kingdom was
right,
carried off.
Right, and the Lamanites would be from Joseph's tribe, right?
Yeah, but Mormons...
They weren't in the Southern Kingdom with Judah. So anyway.
If you get your patriarchal blessing, it'll generally say Ephraim, and sometimes it says Manasseh.
Right.
And if you get a really crazy patriarch, it might say something else. But so a lot of Mormons think the lost 10 tribes are everybody but Ephraim and Manasseh. And then they get into all sorts of things, you know, because even in the Bible, it doesn't identify the 12 tribes the same all the time. And it's most likely a myth that was grafted on later, you know, that to explain, it was like a just so story to explain the geographical regions, you know, because it more corresponded to these provinces than actual like 12 brothers. I mean, that if there's any myth around, that's one of them.
Well, I'm just finished reading Who Wrote the Bible, and they talk a lot about it was a pretty tribal society back then. So there were different tribes that identified with different people of the, you know what I mean? They identified with a different son.
Well,
you know,
mythologically, I think.
Yeah.
But, you
not,
know,
yeah.
In the ancient world, 70 miles away was a long ways
right,
away.
Yeah.
And you know, so you would marry very close to home because you just wouldn't. So when you talk about the kingdom of Judah or the, you know, kingdom of Israel, which was still only, 150 miles and 50 miles wide or whatever, that's still a big distance if you're on foot,
right.
You know. So most people would have never really ventured outside of their little province. But there are those who argue that the 12 apostles were appointed because of the 12 tribes, those things match up. And early Mormon leaders such as Brigham Young and Heber Kimball preached that the 12 were responsible for the 12 tribes, that they matched up. And I wouldn't be surprised if in their own little secret room in Salt Lake City, they still say, oh, you are the guy over Benjamin and you are the guy over Judah. So there's still that strong indication of that we're all divided up in the 12. Now, here's where we're getting to speculative theology. There are those who say that God has 12 wives and that's why we're in those 12 tribes, because that refers to our mother, which is the reason why they never name the mother, because we don't all have the same mother. And actually the early brethren and the polygamists today call, when you have 12 wives, a quorum of wives, that's a complete set of wives. So you've made it when you get to 12, and then you have one for every month.
I was going to say, what are the rest, extra credit? What?
So anyway, the 12 tribes, you know, not to belabor the point, but too late, really does play out an important role in Mormonism today, and it's still there. Most Mormons can tell you what tribe they belong to.
Now, could Battlestar Galactica be playing on that folk doctrine of the 12 tribes being out, or the lost 10 tribes being out in space somewhere?
I'm sure that tickles some people. You know, some people believe that you can find people in any ward who believe these things. Don't get me wrong, but there's some people believe they're in the middle of the Earth, and there's some people who believe they're on another planet.
That a chunk of Earth was removed to another.
Yeah, and
part of the universe.
I would refer everybody back to an early episode where we have on the about Thor, lore and mythology about the 10 tribes, because it's not just Mormonism, but it does play a modern significance.
But in Battlestar Galactica, if I'm remembering correctly, they all know, all but Earth know each other, and they interact with each other, and they travel between the planets, and they have their own society. And this race of robots comes in and wipes out all of the planets in a sneak attack, and the people that are left band together to go try to find the one tribe that's missing.
Well, they
and
call it the 13th tribe,
right,
actually.
Mm-hmm. Right. The one tribe that they don't know about. They don't know where it is. It's written about in the old scriptures. And they know it's called Earth, and they know it's out there somewhere. So it's actually kind of opposite of, rather than 10 tribes being lost, there's only one tribe that's lost, and they're trying to find them so they can, you know, have that be their home now.
Mm-hmm. The old scriptures, meaning the Book of the Word.
Right. I think that's what they call it.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I was just making reference that, like the Book of Mormon, their scriptures right. are called the Book of the Word.
Right.
Well, and I take that mostly, you know, obviously it's still science fiction. He's not like playing out of the playbook completely.
Right.
But you know, the Earth sort of is like the Book of Mormon, where you have this other lost sheep who are somehow kept separate from the rest of the tainted world and somehow kept pure. And there's this yearning to find them. And I think that story plays out in the Book of Mormon a couple different times.
So can I throw in something that's completely off topic but kind of fits? The thing that I always noticed during the episodes is that no matter where they landed, they all spoke the same language. So my speculative theology for Battlestar Galactica is that they were all speaking pure Adamic. That's why they could all understand each other.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
I love it. I was just confused that, you know, the Cylons, this robot race, was wiping out the humans. So they all banded together under Commander Adama. That's where Adama's art comes from, is Adama is the commander over the whole fleet of the last surviving humans. But everywhere they went, there were humans all over the place. I'm like, well, I guess humans aren't as in danger of, of extinction as they thought, or they are really scattered.
Yeah, that was funny. Zilpha and I watched the reboot series first, and you know, they really did play out. The humans were this last surviving band,
and there were no others anywhere.
But
except
in the first episode, every other episode they're running into other people.
The original series, there were people everywhere.
So let's go to the Cylons and talk about the Luciferian or the demonic elements in there, which is the fun part. So the story begins, because we never even set this stage here, that the Cylons are this race of robots that were created by a people called the Cylons, right, who we never really quite – they're apparently lizard-like, but we never really quite meet them. But they were created for this purpose, and they had wiped out another civilization, and now they were going after the humans. So they go and they try to do this mass extinction of the human beings, and the last – Battlestar, this last battleship, has a fleet of 220 spaceships. Come on, you guys.
Yeah, that's right.
200 something.
Yeah, so, and then that's the premise of the series. They're going around. But there is one guy, this turncoat named Baltar, right?
Baltar. Is Gaius in the new one only?
Gaius is in the new one.
Yeah, I think they only
have one. No, he's in both of them.
Did they call him Gaius, though?
They call him Gaius.
Oh, okay, I got you.
Yeah, I think it's just Baltar.
I thought they called him Gaius at first, though.
So Baltar was from the Council of the Twelve. We just talked about 12. There was a Council of the Twelve in Battlestar Galactica, which represented the 12 colonies, the 12 tribes.
Yeah, a governing council.
So Baltar was on the 12 and betrayed them to the Cylons. And his betrayal was that he would get his own world, right?
His own
power, which is obviously a play on Judas, and then on, in Mormon theology, on the Satan himself. Because in Mormon theology, Satan was one of the high and powerful ones, the brother of all of us, including Christ, who betrayed them, betrayed all of us, and started the big war in heaven
to try to get power.
Right, and then there are the sort of, especially if you go to early Mormon doctrine, these mindless, lazy individuals who follow Satan because they don't want to be challenged. They don't want the challenge of life. And they follow him. And now they are the demons, the one third, the host of heaven, which was cast out, who are basically the Cylons. Who are mindless, just sort of going after and will do the will of Baltar. And in the show, Baltar sits in on his throne in this room, and Zilpha asks, well, what does he do when they don't? Because they always walk in and he turns around and he's sitting in this big empty room. Like, what does he do the rest of the time? Does he play Tetris or does he just sit in this empty room? Which is a question about what the devil does all day long too, and God for that matter, but I digress.
I think that theme plays out in a couple of different ways in Battlestar. They also come across Count Ipley, and he is a charismatic figure that asks the people on the different ships, please come follow me. I will take care of you. I will give you everything you need if you just agree to make me your leader, if you just agree to do whatever I tell you to do. And he doesn't try to force them. He tries to persuade them by showing them all these miraculous things that he can do. And then he asks them, it has to be your choice if you'll come follow me, if you'll let me be your commander. And in the end, he turns out to be another incarnation of the devil. And I'm not 100% sure on this, but I believe Ibli, I-L-B-I-S, or however it's spelled, I believe that's the devil in
Islam,
yeah. So he turns out to be the devil, and when Ibli kills Apollo, and they're taken up, and Apollo is one of the warriors in Battlestar, they're taken up to this starship that doesn't really have any distinct, you know, characteristics other than it's white and there's flowing curtains everywhere, and they all have veils on their faces, the people who are on the ship.
Not just the women?
No, all of them.
Oh, okay.
I'm not even sure if there were women. They kind of seemed androgynous, but they...
Oh, dear. And we'll be like them as we are, they will
be... Yes, we'll
be androgynous. Whatever that couplet was.
But I believe they're called Seraphs, and they start talking to the people that they've taken up into the ship, including Apollo, and saying that Ibli is one of them, and he's been cast out because he doesn't want people to have free agency. He wants to be in control of them, and that is not the way of the Seraphs. So he's not allowed to be with them. So that's, I think, yet another way that Larson played out that whole story of Lucifer being cast out because he wanted to be in control of everybody and have power for himself.
Well, that whole episode was really fascinating. It had, one thing, there was that scene between Count Ibli and Baltar, and Baltar sees him and he's like, I know your voice, you know, and Count Ibli calls him his old friend and stuff like that. And it turns out that they got the same actor who plays the voice of the Cylon Imperius leader. And so it comes out, like, it's kind of hinted at in the conversation between Baltar and Count Ibli, that's why the Cylons, who the original reptile Cylons before they built the robots, that they gave up their power to Count Ibli, and because they followed him, they inscribed his voice into their imperious leader, and so that's why their race eventually declined and the robots took them over. They came to love their technology too much. So,
well, wow. For those who don't like temple content, you can fast forward 2 minutes. So let's go back to the temple. Before 1990, there was another character in the temple of the preacher who wore a Protestant, collar. And the Protestant is the one, the preacher is the one who led them in the hymn. And basically the temple played him out that the preachers were the agents of the devil, that they, and the preacher discovers in the temple ceremony that he has been working for, without knowing, it's sort of left ambiguous in the temple ceremony, but the idea that there are these direct agents, you know, and the whore of the world, you know, the great and abominable Catholic Church, and all these things who are unwittingly the masters of these higher masters. And I really liked in that episode when the angels say, you know, we cannot interfere with the freedom of choice, his, yours, anyone's. And that is sort of that Mormon doctrine thing, which is the explanation for evil, for the solution for the theodicy in Mormonism, is that God can't interfere with evil because That would interfere with choice. Now, it never explains why the devil can get away with interfering with everybody's freedom, but that's the explanation as to why God doesn't stop evil. So it's this central doctrine of free agency that we have to have in order to complete the plan, and that the agents of the devil, be they preachers in the temple or Cylon robots, are really there trying to wipe us out because we're free to choose good over evil.
And they don't like that.
No, they don't. I'm not exactly sure why they don't like that. But.
Well, in Mormon theology, it's because they've been denied that ability because they wouldn't go along with Jesus.
So they're jealous.
But yeah. Don't they choose to tempt people?
Yeah, it seems like they would have to do that.
Yeah.
Well, speculative theology for me again. I've always thought it was because they didn't really know what they were getting themselves into when they went with Satan. It was only after they were cast out that they were like,
right.
Rats.
So then why wouldn't they fight against Satan and rather?
Yeah,
why
didn't they say, oh, we made the wrong choice. I'm going to return this model to the dealership.
They don't have a body, so they don't have a choice, which is contradictory, right, to how we chose to come here. But.
Yeah,
that's what I was always.
So I'm glad there's no organizations today that would want to take away choice and like lock things up on Sunday or not allow you to buy certain liquids or do that kind of thing, because that would definitely be Satan's plan to not give you the choice of going swimming
on a
Sunday.
Forced obedience.
So
you mean?
Yeah. So just a little test I'm throwing out there for finding the true church. All right. So as long as we're talking about that, let's talk about episode 7 and the long patrol. So Starbuck, you know, once again, the warrior who's always getting in trouble, he finds
Can I bring up one more thing about the devil in Battlestar Galactica?
Yeah, that episode is really interesting.
Well, right. We see Count Ibley. The Mormon Satan within Baltar. We see him in Count Ibley. There is a character named Lucifer.
Yes, there is. Mm-hmm.
There is this robot that helps Baltar. And... as a gay man myself, my gaydar went ding ding ding. He's
mine
a total
too.
Queen.
He was a gay robot. I agree.
Total queen. He has these luscious lips and, you know, flowing glittery robes, and you know they give him kind of this feminine British accent, and he's flitting about trying to help Baltar as this Lucifer. And I was wondering, maybe it's that some Mormons believe that Satan's gay or Lucifer's gay. Maybe that's what. Maybe that was bigger in the 70s.
I have heard that teaching before.
But he is. But this Lucifer character, he's keen on learning the humans, which I think ties back to this idea that the Cylons are not human or are interested in the bodies of human or trying to be more human, trying to tie that to the followers of Satan being without bodies and jealous of that.
Yeah, and he very much, again, with the temple, you can fast forward another minute. He, again, reminded me of that, you know, of that temple, you know, when they go into the Greek temple and then God says this and then they walk, they turn around. It's always this.
In Battlestar?
Yeah, because, you know, in the temple, it's always they go up, God tells Jesus to do something, then Jesus tells Peter to do it.
The lines of authority.
And then 15 minutes later, we get back to the thing and then they do it again. And then 15 minutes later... So they do the exact same thing in Battlestar. They go into that chamber, and then God says things, and then what is it that the Lucifer always says in Battlestar?
By your command.
And he says it in that sort of feminine, sarcastic
By your
way.
Command.
I did like, he is my favorite character because he's always like, that seems like a strange move. Why would you do that? So
you know best, by your command.
Yeah, excellent point. Okay, so let's talk about the long patrol. So Starbuck goes down to this planet, and he finds this people who are living in these jail cells. And the jail cells don't have any locks. They've long since rotted away. And the guards are kind of like half-assed in what they're doing. But we find out that these people have been here for generations, just mating and being born and staying in their cells, which, of course, is a play on the Mormon take on the Christian concept of original sin. Mm-hmm. The idea that we are all, you know, we all need to be delivered from that, because in early Mormon theology, that was ridiculed very openly, this idea that, and of course it's in the 13
articles
of faith that man must be punished for their own sins and not for Adam's transgression, unless you're black. and so I think that's a real Mormon sort of hidden play that these guys are stuck in those cells and of their own doing.
Well, yeah, and they're actually named after the sin that was committed by their ancestors 700 years before them. Like one of them is called Assault 9, another one is Forger 7, Adulteress 15, and they name Starbucks, since he's new there, his name is going to be Bootlegger, so he's going to be the original sin of bootlegging.
Yeah, and what they do for fun is they all make hooch, if I remember right. Don't they make
absinthe?
Yeah.
Well, they're doing it for a cause. They think they're giving it to the colonies to fight the war or something like that. So they take it very patriotically or something.
Yeah, but. Yeah.
Yep, so Starbuck makes them realize that they don't have to be prisoners anymore for what their forefathers did, and that they have the right to be free.
Mm-hmm. So is that a Christ-like?
Yeah, it seems
portrayal?
Like it. To me, it's almost like Christ going to the prison, the spirit prison after.
I thought Starbuck was more Joseph Smith. He was sort of a womanizing, you know, kind of wild, crazy guy. He was always crashing on the planets, but getting out by the hair of his teeth.
Well, that's true. Starbuck was,
you know,
charismatic.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's Dirk Benedict.
Yeah, I saw somebody posted on Facebook the other day. I'll find this picture and post it. It had a picture of Thrace, the new Starbuck, with the old Starbuck at Starbucks. Oh, you have it right there.
That's awesome.
Starbuck and Starbuck at Starbucks. Yeah. But Benedict has had a little bit of surgery there. It's pretty clear. But yeah, the Starbucks, Joseph Smith, and the lady Joseph Smith. Maybe that's the one, Mighty and Strong, that's yet to come.
Ouch.
Okay, so you know, I think we've hit some of the major points, but there are a lot of like minor things that just show up, and if you're a Mormon, you'll hear them all the time. First of all, eternal marriage shows up in the and they actually even use the word sealing at one point. And I don't think they said new and everlasting covenant. They said something sort of
for time and all eternity.
Yeah, they have a wedding, and they use those words.
Not only for now, but all the eternities.
So
I declare
about,
you sealed.
About that episode, it was kind of interesting because you know how one of the ways that in church they kind of get you to see the value of a temple marriage as opposed to a civil marriage is, did you ever hear that kind of folk story about the couple who they get married and they have a civil ceremony, but then they get in a car wreck on their way to their honeymoon. And so they can never be together again because they had that civil ceremony. It seems like this episode is the reverse of that. It's like the good side of that, where you've got this relationship developing between Apollo and Serena, and they get married, and then she gets killed mortally wounded by the Cylons, and you have this kind of touching moment between them when they're supposed to be like, but we'll be together forever because now we've been sealed, that kind of thing. And it was really interesting to me because as I was watching that, I was like, wow, I would not want to be married forever to somebody that I dated for like 2 months and we were married for a day, and you know, now I'm stuck with you forever.
That's exactly
okay, fun.
What I thought.
And her first husband had died in the attack, right?
I thought he'd run off.
Oh, he runt off. Oh, R-U-N-N-O-F-T.
And you like how their relationship is developed by her watching Apollo play with her son, which isn't that how BYU always works? There's that test date where you take them to be with kids to see how they are around kids.
And
that's the sign of a good mate, you know?
Around their mother, although I don't think Apollo's mother ever.
Yeah, she's
up.
Not in there.
No.
Yeah.
Well, but I think that's what struck me as very Mormon about Battlestar Galactica is it really is something you could sit down and watch for family home evening. Oh, it's very
totally.
You know, the main guy, Apollo, he's single, but he immediately becomes this family man. He marries Jane Seymour, who's gorgeous, and then her son, who later goes on to play Atreyu in the Neverending Story.
Yes.
But it's very patriarchal. You know, the great strong guys going out and the ladies, you know, back watching, giggling, and a lot of nods to it's very inclusive of children. They love to play with the little boy and the little boy and his fun robot toys. It's very family values, very
chimp,
wholesome entertainment with the capital W, which is not the case for the remake.
The remake's dirty. It's
darker.
Great.
Yeah. Well, I really like how the remake updates those gender politics because it yes. needed to be updated very much.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. I love the way that they play. I know I thought is the remake as liberal as the original was conservative? Maybe. I don't know.
The original was conservative, but they did have, you know, Commander Ty was black, and they did have, and they made it, they made a sort of a play on it where all the pilots, all the warriors were men, basically, but then they were very stereotypical and very, like, derogatory towards women. You know, they were all giggly.
But they had the women become pilots.
But they did become pilots. They did.
But even was it Sheba who was a pilot later, and she was pretty tough, but she would still go back and kind of chill with the ladies. I mean, yeah. she wasn't like a Starbuck figure in
An interesting piece of trivia is that she never uses her laser gun once in the entire series.
I didn't women pick up on that. Aim. Oh, my goodness.
I mean, we'll give them credit where credit. They are a little bit progressive in it. Yeah. But, you know, building on what you're saying.
Princess Leia was before that, and she was tougher.
Yeah. Oh, I guess. But
well, at least when the women fighters take over for the men because the men are all sick, they don't in their first battle they don't have any casualties. They do true. Really awesome. So yeah, that's something, like, I guess.
The stripling,
but it's immediately
warriors.
Undercut by that scene where Apollo and Starbuck are making fun of the way women talk and mm-hmm. things like that.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
I did want to comment on the Adama thing, and it was a facet of American culture, but very Mormon thing. You have this gray-haired member of the Council of the Twelve who is always talking in a God voice. He doesn't have any human characteristics. He always is 100% spot on right. Mm-hmm. He is to be, you know, the men are to be followed and they guide and they, you know, and it does show him sometimes like concerned over his people, but never like concerned over his own decisions. He's, you know, he's always 100% right. And that's a very Mormon theme too.
But the new Galactica, they struggle with those issues a lot. And I appreciated that aspect of the new Galactica where they really struggled with what to do and what was the right thing. And they questioned their decisions that they made before
and they often made wrong decisions. Towards right. the end of the new one, I found myself agreeing with the Cylons.
Oh, yeah. Right.
Just to wipe them out.
But the other thing on that Adama that's very Mormon is there is no woman there, you know, and all the women are in positions where they take orders from everybody else and from the command men. And that's, you know, that when it's just like the mother in heaven, she disappears. The wives of the Quorum of the Twelve, they just show up in sort of frou-frou ways. You know,
yeah, there are no real mothers leadership. In the series.
There is that one episode, like towards the end of the series, it's the one where Baltar escapes. And the tension that's going on there is that there's a female member of the council has been asked to kind of be a watchdog over Adama, and she makes all the bad decisions acting on behalf of the council. Like she's saying, don't do this, don't do that. And it's all the wrong decisions. It completely blows up in their faces and things like that. But she does have some redeeming aspects in that she gives a good military strategy towards the end. And then Adama and that woman are seen kind of dating in the end. So.
Yeah, definitely. All right. Well, is there any other?
I have two.
Okay.
The first one is that, in episode 2, they're just barely out on their voyage trying to find Earth, and they stumble upon this planet where, it's kind of like Las Vegas. People are gambling and having fun, and all of them got there on these transport type buses. And, what they don't realize is that when they go down, when they get in the elevator to go down to their hotel room to retire for their night, they're actually going to hell to, you know, be tortured. And that really struck me as a commentary on people along the Wasatch Front getting on a fun bus and going to Wendover. That kind of stuck out to me. And the other thing was... Sorry.
How did you know we were having a Mormon Expression-sponsored fun bus? You were trying to...
Oh, I'm totally there. And I'll just not take the elevator down. then also in episode 17, they have these Beryllian, I think that's how you say it, gnomon. And they're kind of like... assassins of some sort, and I kind of wondered if they were supposed to be the Danites. If that was what was playing out there, they were.
Well, they look like Klingons from Star Trek. They look different. Yeah. But yeah, I picked up on Nomans, sounds like Mormons. And they also mention at some point the unpardonable sin, which for them was like not praying, but they were being deceitful. It was all. all for their collusion. But yeah, they use the phrase the unpardonable sin.
And then one tiny one, in the episode, that same episode actually, Starbuck's father is called a genetic tracer, and I thought that was a little nod to genealogy.
Genetic tracer.
Yeah, I have a ton, too many to list now, but I'll pick a couple. One is the use of euphemisms for profanity, like frack, you know?
Yes.
Like
Glenn Larson did invent the term frack.
Yeah.
So. I find it really interesting that it was the Mormons who figured out how to get the F word on television. Because you know, every time they said frack, what people were thinking in their heads. Mm-hmm. So right. Mormons were the
especially
ones who got the F word on TV.
In the 2003
yeah,
season.
Yeah, in the new
in
one.
The reboot, they use that to
all
refer
the
to
time.
Intercourse.
Yeah, they use it in every single way you can use the F word. The original you know, maybe a few times.
Mm-hmm. And they have some other weird words they show in there.
Felder carp.
Yeah.
Felder garb. Yeah. Something like that. Another one that, I don't know, this is kind of out there, but in that one episode, The Long Patrol, there's kind of a side plot going on. Like before he goes to that planet where all the prisoners are and things like that, he is kind of playing between two women. Like he's playing between Athena, who is Adama's daughter, and Cassiopeia, who eventually becomes his true girlfriend. But he's kind of playing between the two of them and having a romantic affair between the two of them. And then later on, when he disappears, Athena comes up to Cassiopeia and she's like saying, you know, I kind of just felt I should tell you that Starbuck's missing. It just seemed like the right thing to do. And there's kind of almost, I'm sorry, but it seemed like just a sister wife moment, you know, where they were like, you know, I just had to share this with you. And they have this bonding moment between the two of them. And they're like, you know, when Starbuck comes back, we're still going to fight over him. And they were like, I wouldn't have it any other way. And then when he comes back, they're both sitting on either side of him at the dinner table and stuff like that. So that was kind of a weird thing for me anyway, but yeah.
Anything else?
I did. I picked up on that polygamy idea, you know, maybe just totally reading into it, the polygamy idea with the two of them. And then Commander Kane, this other Battlestar Galactica or Battlestar appears,
the
and
Pegasus.
Commander Kane is on there, who apparently Cassiopeia had a relationship with in the past. And there's a wide generation difference. So I'm like, oh, here's Cassiopeia again. But with kind of that fear of fundamentalist polygamy now about intergenerational intimacy sort of idea.
Well, this series was canceled after one season and then they tried to restart it in the 80s. And a lot of the stuff that I read about the connections to Mormonism also talked about that second little blurb that didn't last very long because it was even more horrible than the original. Apparently in one of those episodes, Apollo and Starbuck refer to the Book of the Word and how some of their ancient leaders married very young wives. So there's another allusion.
Yeah, I didn't bother watching that. It was roundly panned. Mm-hmm.
I think even like diehard Battlestar Galactica fans deny it exists.
Well, Richard Hatch and Benedict and all those other guys weren't in it. So
only Boxy, I think, was in it. Well, and
can I ask a question? We were talking about Cassiopeia. When she is introduced in the series, it's this vaguely biblical moment where Apollo is among the refugees or something. And then there's Cassiopeia like in these Bible-like robes or something. And he's like, you're hurt. And she's like, no, go help the other people. And then everyone's like, ew, she's evil. Get away from her. It was like, you know, the woman taken in adultery sort of thing.
Yeah.
And then she says that they're rejecting her because she's a socialator.
Yeah.
And they never explain what that is.
I thought it was a prostitute. Said,
they implied later, I think.
And then, but then she says it's a profession with the blessings of the elders. So I thought that was weird. I'm like, so a sympathetic prostitute. This was way before Pretty Woman, but
probably like a geisha was probably the idea.
Yeah, I think that what's that other series that played on that theme?
Yeah. Oh yes, Firefly.
Firefly. That's right. Yeah, they
had a socialite.
I thought they were playing on that. They got that from Battlestar. So,
okay.
All right. Yeah. I mean, I think there's little references and little smatterings, and you'll pick them up when you watch the show. But all right. Well, any other lasting thoughts on? Oh, I do have to ask this because I thought it was the most bizarre thing of the new series. They introduced Boxy, and on like episode 2, and then he just disappears. Was that like a contract problem, or did somebody blow up? And you know, because he's there in the, and then they just never explained.
I think they realized that trying to have kids on every episode was just too much hassle, and it is definitely an adult show, so they thought, yeah, we don't really need a lot of kids in here.
Everyone should see the new Battlestar. The whole thing, as everything slowly falls apart, that's the best. And every character is flawed in one way or the other. You go from one episode thinking, oh, he's great, to like, what a son of a bitch.
And that's the special effects are quite amazing for a show. I mean, for a TV show.
Yeah, I think the first two seasons of Battlestar Galactica are some of the best television ever. You know, yeah,
right, they're cool. Right, hands down.
In some of the reading online that I was doing in preparation for this, I came across several blogs that hated the new Battlestar Galactica because it was it dissed religion, and it didn't reflect positively or kindly upon religion. And I take great exception to that because I think that the original Battlestar Galactica, it kind of just sprinkled in Mormon theology. It didn't really deal with it. You know, it was just there. But in the new Battlestar Galactica, it really delves into people's faith and whether or not they believe and why they should believe. And in the end, the predictions in their ancient texts turn out to have somehow come true. And it kind of leaves open room for discussion about, is it a self-fulfilling prophecy? If these ancient texts didn't exist, would they have behaved in some other way and ended up somewhere else and it wouldn't have been Earth? And I think it gives a much deeper and more interesting look at religion instead of just sprinkling it in there and being like, yay, positive for religion, you know?
I agree. Yeah, and I think it does play out the tension between agnosticism, atheism, and religion. And does that even matter? You know, if you don't believe, do the gods even care? You know, is it better to be good or is it better to be a believer? And Baltar's whole religion thing, I thought that subtext.
Baltar was so much more interesting in the second one.
Yeah, yeah.
He was a three-dimensional character.
Annoying.
Well, and so were the Cylons. They had genuine motivations for doing the things that they did. They weren't just pure evil and out to destroy everybody. Yeah.
Right. All right, guys.
Can I ask one more question before
we
finish?
Go ahead.
Do you guys think that Larson was trying to promote Mormonism? Or do you think he just liked it and sprinkled it in?
My personal belief is no. I think he was just using that as a venue, sort of the same way Card does. Well, maybe Card is trying to promote Mormonism these days. I don't know. Card's gone crazy. But I just think he was using it. And I think he was using Greek stuff and other things, but he didn't understand them as well. So it was just, you know, if you read the Book of Abraham just on a lark, it's a funny, little, interesting book.
So he was just having fun with it.
That's my take.
That was the impression I got. And I found a lot of places online where people were saying, if Harry Potter's going to be lambasted for being pagan and, you know, other like VeggieTales is Christian, why is nobody paying attention to the fact that Battlestar Galactica is preaching Mormonism? And I found one guy who, his name is Dr. P. Bradley Carey, and I don't know exactly who he is. I think he's an evangelical guy. And he... apparently there's a lot of evangelicals who just hate Battlestar Galactica and think it's like some Mormon plot to like infect people with our propaganda. And he said, with all of the small children, as well as adults watching the program, there's a great deal of influence being programmed into the viewers' minds. Later in life, or perhaps even now, the Mormons will come to your door and the seed will have already been planted. The Mormons will start telling you about their beliefs and it will somehow sound vaguely familiar to you. The Mormons will then tell you that that this is the Spirit of God telling you that these things are true. So I thought that was interesting to show just how the greater world, especially in evangelical Christianity, do not trust Mormons at all.
Well,
they don't see it as just a fun thing.
We've heard the same complaint with Twilight, is that it's trying to indoctrinate people. And I think there may be a pressure with Mormon artists. I mean, that there's definitely a pride that you have as a believing Mormon in these stories and your scriptures and the uniqueness that they can offer to the world. And so I think on some level, maybe that pride would feed into the creative process. So maybe not actively proselyting, but...
Yeah, one irony about that is that I think there are actually some really strong episodes in terms of their artistic value in the original Battlestar series, but the ones that didn't work were the religious ones for me, the ones that were being so heavy-handed and didactic and things like that. Mm-hmm. So for me, like, it was the religious things that didn't work. I don't know. Mm-hmm.
For me too, but if you were a believer, it would probably speak more to you. I mean, you know, if you were a strong believer.
All right. Well, thanks, everybody. It was an interesting discussion. Go out and see Battlestar Galactica.
Especially the new series.
Yeah.
Definitely.
All right. Elisa, Heather, Zilpha, Trevor.
Good night.
Oh, Travis.
Sorry. I'm sorry.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Thanks, Travis.